Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The last barely functioning hospital in northern Gaza is a humanitarian disaster zone, the UN World Health Organization WHO said on Tuesday, highlighting the disastrous consequences of ongoing Israeli bombardment for critically ill and injured civilians across the enclave. Briefing reporters from Gaza, Dr. Richard Pieperkorn, WHO's representative in the occupied Palestinian territory, described corridors overflowing with trauma patients at Al Ahli Hospital in Gaza City, where fuel, oxygen, food and water are scarce.
I've never seen scenes like this in my life. The doctors are really forced to prioritize who receives care, who doesn't. They're treating many of the serious cases in the corridors or on the floor.
In just 66 days of fighting, the Strip has been transformed from a reasonably functioning health system producing health indicators on par with neighboring countries to a situation where more than two-thirds of its 36 hospitals and over 70% of primary healthcare facilities are out of commission, Dr. Pieperkorn said. Last Saturday, a WHO-led UN and Palestine Red Crescent Society PRCS convoy encountered serious incidents during a mission to deliver trauma and surgical supplies for 1,500 patients to the hospital and evacuate 19 critical patients and their companions to the south, the UN health agency said. The convoy was stopped twice at a checkpoint and medical staff were detained, causing delays. One of the injured patients reportedly died as a result of his untreated wounds. Staying with health, half of the world's population is not fully covered by essential health services, and 2 billion people are impoverished because they must cover medical bills out of pocket. WHO warned on Universal Health Coverage Day, observed on Tuesday, that without urgent action, these gaps will only widen. Health Agency Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus stressed that investing in resilient health systems based on strong primary health care is the most inclusive, equitable, and cost-effective path towards universal health coverage, defined as a situation where all people can access the health services they need without financial hardship. Health systems that can respond to shocks, such as the fast-advancing climate emergency, can avert millions of additional deaths each year, WHO insisted. In a political declaration last September, world leaders committed to redouble their efforts to achieve universal health coverage by 2030. WHO said that it is working with countries to reorient health systems towards a primary healthcare approach that can help deliver 90% of essential health services while saving 60 million lives by 2030. Food insecurity has continued to worsen in West and Central Africa, with the number of hungry people set to reach a staggering 49.5 million by the middle of next year, UN humanitarians said on Tuesday. Acute hunger remains at record levels in the region, yet funding needed to respond is not keeping apace. UN World Food Programme WFP Regional Director Margot van der Velden said, stressing that for lack of funds, WFP has been forced to scale back life-saving assistance for those in need. Acute hunger in West and Central Africa is mainly driven by conflict, which has driven millions out of their homes and farms, along with the climate crisis and high food and fuel prices. More than 2 in 3 households cannot afford healthy diets, the cost of which in countries like Burkina Faso, Mali and Niger is 110% higher than the daily minimum wage. 4 in 5 of the region's youngest children do not consume the minimum number of food groups they need for optimal growth and development, WFP warned, together with the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, and the Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO. In the first 10 months of 2023, 1.9 million children under 5 were admitted for treatment due to severe wasting across 9 Sahel countries, representing a 20% increase from last year. Dominika Tomaszewska-Mortimer, UN News.
And good afternoon. I hope you're having a wonderful day. Here is, in the second hour,
the emissions from war and militarism are overlooked at this conference of the parties. And it has been for many years, and that's because in 1997 at the Kyoto Protocol negotiations, the United States ensured that military emissions were not part of the Kyoto Protocol, that they would be exempted.
The climate toll of war, Tamara Lawrence, on the next broadcast of TUC Radio.
That's coming up in the second hour following this latest Radio Eco Shock.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
You know the globalized food supply is fragile. Experts find food riots are possible even in the United Kingdom as climate change ramps up. From Cambridge, Alla Jones outlines how food stress boils over. Around the world, crops may not be planted or harvested because it's too hot to work outside. From Columbia University, Connor Dunn-Diaz reports. Plus, selections by Dr. Vanessa Andreotti on final care for an age on life support. Her book, Hospicing Modernity. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShot. Dozens of experts say food riots could erupt in the UK within the next 50 years and maybe in the next 10. Really, is that possible? As in many countries, the population was shocked at the fragility of food in the early 2020 COVID shutdowns. Food prices are still very high, and 2023 bad weather damaged UK crops. We all need to know about food security as the climate shifts. Dr. Alla Jones is a member of the Science Advisory Group for the UK Global Food Security Program as director of the Global Sustainability Institute at Anglia Ruskin University. Jones is lead author of a big new expert survey on UK food. In October, they published Scoping Potential Routes to UK Civil Unrest via the Food System. From Cambridge, Alla Jones, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Is a real food crisis bringing rioters out on the streets? It hasn't happened for over 100 years. And you advised the UK government on food security. You were part of the UK-US Task Force on Extreme Weather and Global Food Resilience. Why your continuing concern?
I think what we've seen around the world is more tension and more problems within the food system. So as you said in the introduction, food prices are at an all-time high. And also the use of things like food banks, where people are reliant on donations for food in the UK, is at an all-time high. So the pressure in the food system is really high. And while we haven't seen riots of really large scale within the UK for many decades, we have seen small-scale riots and protests around availability of food, both in the UK but also across Europe. So really the question is, what are the things that will trigger people going out and protesting, and how those protests become riots, and what we can do to try and alleviate that pressure so that people feel secure in their access to food going forward?
And your analysis finds civil unrest could develop even if the country doesn't actually run out of food. What is another possible cause?
So even if we don't run out of food, there's two different causes there. One is distribution and the other is price. So even if we've got enough food, if it's unaffordable for the majority of people, then obviously they can't access it. Or if we have a distribution problem, whether that's problems with transport or logistics in moving food around the country, then it's not necessary that the whole country will experience protests or disturbances around access to food, but it could be pockets that appear where that distribution has not been possible.
The new paper points to, quote, the rise in social media and sensationalist journalism, and with the public expectation that one should be able to buy anything more or less at the same price at any time of year. Talk to us about the fragility of public expectations in the developed world.
What we've seen is that people now do expect the system to be able to provide what they need when they need it, and also that it should be affordable. We've seen globalization has provided us with supply chains that can provide any fruit or vegetable at any time of the year, and people have got used to that and used to being able to buy fruit and veg at times of the year where you couldn't grow them domestically. So with that expectation becomes additional fragility. So as soon as, and we saw this during COVID and within the UK as well, when the UK left the European Union, we saw disruptions to supply chains, and there was a lot of tension within the consumer groups about just some products not being available, whether that was tomatoes or lettuce. It didn't spill over to riots, but you could see the tension within the system rise because some supply chains stopped working. And when it's food in particular, those tensions can rise quite rapidly. And we've certainly seen it in many countries around the world where access to particular sorts of food can lead to rioting and can lead to protest very rapidly.
As we speak, wet weather damaged local UK vegetables, straining some supermarket staples for the holiday season. But can't we always import more if climate instability hits?
What we've been seeing, especially in the UK, is this assumption that we can always import, that the international markets will be able to help us withstand any local and domestic shocks. And certainly for the UK, we import approximately half our food all the time. So we're very reliant on international markets. The challenges that we're going to face going forward is around disruptions to those supply chains, either because we change trade agreements, and we saw that with the European Union in the UK, or because you've got increasing impacts of things like climate change around the world, where large breadbaskets, so these are areas that grow a lot of our food, for example in the US or in Ukraine and Russia or in China and across Europe, where they get disrupted, and we have seen losses of 10% of global food, global wheat or global rice in a given year. Sometimes we have the stocks to be able to withstand those sorts of shocks, but you can imagine quite easily at the sort of perfect storm of losing wheat harvests in the US due to food and floods or droughts, coupled with extreme rainfall in the UK, meaning that international prices are really high. So up until this point, we've been able to outbid poorer countries or stabilize our supply chains, but we can't always rely on being able to outbid everybody on international markets.
Well, so in an emergency, could the country feed itself as it tried to do in World War II?
So what happened in World War II was a dramatic change in the way we used our landscape. We were also a much smaller population and much less reliant on imports. So currently, the 50% reliance on imports, there is the possibility of changing what we eat, so we would have to be much less reliant on meat, so that the per calorie output from our land was much higher, so that we're not feeding food to animals and then creating that supply chain. So yes, the UK could probably be self-sufficient, although there's lots of research going on to see how true that is, but our diets would have to be vastly different from what they are today. And also what we eat and when we eat it would need to be very different. So it's also, of course, it would be very seasonal. So the big question is, how quickly could we change everything? It wouldn't be overnight. People always struggle to change diets over many years. So if suddenly we had to be self-sufficient, then there probably would be a lot of tension in the system, and certainly tension within society and across communities, and resistance to that, the scale of change that would be needed.
Well, what were the questions your new paper with 56 co-authors asked?
So what we asked was very general questions around what do we think the risks are in the food system? How do we see some of these risks playing out over what sort of time scale? And this was general risks across the whole food system. So we covered things like the rise of social media, information, access to knowledge that people have. What does that do in terms of tension within the food system, through to climate change, extreme weather, loss of biodiversity, pollinators, bees, things that are really important, increasing prices into farms, transport, as well as more extreme impacts like extreme space weather, so that disrupting telecommunications, disrupting logistics. So we did ask these experts to try and list as many risks as they could and then put their best estimate at likelihood of these sorts of events happening over a 10 or 50-year time frame.
And what did experts conclude about the chances of food riots in the UK within the next 50 years or even the next 10?
So the vast majority of experts saw over the next 50 years that riots were certainly possible in the UK, and they thought that the drivers for that, the main ones, would be climate change or impacts of climate change, although there are a number of different cascading risks, so climate change impacting some physical loss, but then also impacting transport and impacting societies in different ways. So that kind of multiple risks coming together over the next 50 years. could make accessibility in the UK a problem, and accessibility then leading into some form of riot. Over the shorter period of time, then there was much less consensus. It certainly wasn't the majority. It was a minority of people thought that we could still see some form of protest in the UK, mostly down to accessibility. So that's more about distribution than it is about overall access and availability. But that, you know, that distribution, we could certainly see pockets, especially in areas where there is more poverty in the UK and more people reliant on food banks and donations currently, then a distribution challenge across that kind of supply chain in those regions could lead to some sort of riot or protest.
Unlike the so-called Cardiff Ellie bread riots in 1991, which began really as a business dispute, what is the threshold your team established as a real riot?
So we didn't actually define a threshold. What we did try and say is this is the scale of riot that we wanted people to think about when they were looking at the likelihood of it happening. So the sort of riots that we had were the London riots, which were more around race and the police in the last decade. So we have seen London riots and people going out in the street, committing violence, looting shops. They're very small pockets. So we tried to ask people to imagine what would create that, but on a much larger scale. So not the level on a larger scale, but just more distributed across the UK. So certainly those sorts of race riots type levels that we have seen, but as a result of some sort of crisis in the food system and happening in more than just those localized areas.
Well, in the scenario in the paper, you talk about 30,000 people injured. What do you mean by injured?
So we used the definition that was used in the London riots, and this is how police categorize the impact of the riots. So injuries, as noted by the police, could be anything from people getting injured because of broken glass, ending up in fights. They could be hospitalized, but a lot of those are fairly minor injuries, but some can be fairly major injuries. In separate research, we have been looking at the scale of injury and whether, when you've looked at food riots around the world in the past, some of these protests and riots, especially around North Africa and the Middle East, they lead to death of protesters because of extreme responses by the authorities, or the riots become much larger. And we saw that in the Arab Spring, which then led to governments being toppled. So that kind of threshold is easier to quantify, one person dying. But the definition we used around injuries for this scenario was more around how police would categorize an injury. So has actual bodily harm happened? Would someone be arrested for that? The scale of that, it is quite wide.
If people think food will come within a few days, that is different from a dread of a longer period. Is the response recovery time a factor in whether riots happen? What do you think?
I think that's absolutely true. We didn't ask about response recovery times and how long that would need to be before the protests started to happen. But certainly, if you look at the UK food system and the resilience of it and supply chains, we often say that everyone's 7 days away from food running out. So our supply chains are incredibly efficient and just in time. And a lot of the UK food distribution is on the back of lorries rather than in storage, so it's constantly in movement. So when we look at recovery timescales, we've also got to look at how efficient the system is and how recovery would happen. And that's why I think, it's when the supply chain breaks down, you've got a 3 to 7 day period where the local supply would run out, and how quickly you can then recover means that you've got an additional period of time on that. How people perceive it, and this is where we talk about the rise of social media and the press and how it's talked about. So if it's talked about in a measured way, there's been a supply chain problem, but people are working on it, and supply should be back up in 3 to 5 days, so don't panic. That would help alleviate some of the problems, but if the social media and the newspapers report it as, shock photos of no food on shelves in certain supermarkets, people go out, panic buy, there's even less food then in the system, and that can speed up the problem, and therefore that response time needs to be even shorter. So as soon as people see no food in the shops, then protests can happen really quickly. So that kind of response time depends on how people respond to the initial shock. If shops are empty for 2-3 days, people get very worried very quickly.
Did any of the expert respondents cite hacking, artificial intelligence, or terrorism as a threat to food?
Yeah, so both AI and terrorism were factors linked into some of those risks, as well as, you know, things like food health issues, so outbreaks of different sorts of avian flu in birds or swine flu. So that sort of disease vectors within the food system as well could be a risk, but in particular around AI in logistics and transport and the whole food system and sales, then that's a particular threat, as is direct terrorism, both in terms of physical risks to supply chains and especially global supply chains. So there are particular risk points in the global supply chain, but also through cyber terrorism, taking down transport logistics, that's also a risk to the food system.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Alan Jones, director of the Global Sustainability Institute in Cambridge. He led a study into possible food riots in the United Kingdom as food security breaks down. There are scenarios where the same food breakdowns may not cause mass riots. Consider food shortages during a deadly pandemic or fear of bombardment, something like that. Are food riots inevitable at some point as people starve?
They're not inevitable. And what I think the reason to do this sort of research to understand where the risks come from is how to make them much less likely. When people feel that they are all working together and feel the same risk together, actually protests are much less likely. So if there's a real global threat to food systems, for example, during bombardments in the Second World War, the community tries to support itself to respond. They don't go out and protest because they don't think someone's withholding food or the system isn't working properly. If people think the system is working properly and trying to protect them, but has failed for some reason, that's outside of the system's control, they're much more likely to collaborate and work together. So part of this work isn't to say, you know, riots are inevitable. It's more, let's get the system to respond so people can see that we're working really hard to make this risk much lower. So that if things do happen, and we certainly anticipate climate change impacts to be quite significant over the next 10, 20 years, then people don't think that the system is failing them. They feel as protected as they possibly can, and then they will collaborate, and the outcomes will be much better.
Do you think riots are always bad, always leading to a more broken society, or could riots be cathartic, like revolution needed for new circumstances?
Very interesting question. I think ideally you get a change in the way the system works without the need for a riot. However, some riots and certainly protests in the past have led to positive change. And it's very unfortunate, and we don't want to see people injuring themselves or being injured during those protests to create change. But, you know, the suffragettes or anti-slavery movements, these things have happened because people went out on the street and said, we want to see a system change. I hope it doesn't come to the point where the only way we can get changes in the food system is through protest.
Alla Jones, you've been working on UK food security for many years. Is the government of the people getting any closer to national food readiness for emergencies?
So I think in the UK, not really. We've seen an increasing reliance on international markets and international supply chains. There has been some work around food security, and we've seen reports on food systems and the future of food being commissioned by the UK government, and especially looking at things like diet changes and what we need out of food, as well as strategies around how we ensure domestic production is protected so that we do have some form of domestic production. What we haven't seen is that being joined up into a proper food security strategy looking forward.
This new work asks not just academics, but experts in business and the nonprofit sector. Did you find agreement that climate change is a major factor in food insecurity and how it develops?
Yeah, so from all the experts, it was from a wide range of businesses, government, academics, third sectors, charity sectors, and climate change was by far the biggest factor in creating increased risk in the food system going forward. So there was no disagreement about climate change. It was usually ranked at number one. The differences came in exactly how that would be impacting and over what timescales.
And climate scientists talk of tipping points, although many now prefer thresholds. Do we know what the thresholds and trigger points for populations fearing for their food supply to become riots?
Not really. There is an increasing amount of work trying to understand the food system and its reliance on, in particular, prevailing weather. So there's lots of work, especially around Europe, looking at North Atlantic currents. And what that would do if that slowed down dramatically, what that would do to our prevailing weather system. There are particular local tipping points or thresholds for certain crops in some countries, and they're quite well known and well studied. So if you're growing cocoa in a certain country and the temperature is changing and weather patterns are changing, then it may not be possible to grow cocoa in that particular country. You need to look at alternative crops, but then that means you have to look for different supply chains, different places to sell it. You need to create different markets. So that all takes time. And what we're seeing is that it's taking longer to change the whole supply chain system and market system than climate change is giving us. So there are sort of thresholds both in the social system around food systems, and there are thresholds in the physical system, which means crops are moving further north and some crops are no longer viable in some countries. The big question is, globally, what is there? Is there a threshold in food systems? You know, at what point do extreme weather events become so commonplace that the resilience of the whole system needs to be thought of in a different way?
In this century, there have been food riots in Bangladesh and mostly in North Africa. The 2022 crisis in Sri Lanka was partly due to food and energy shortages, plus wild inflation. But again, there hasn't been a food riot in recent years in the UK, so the population has no experience. I wonder, does that make it harder to predict what comes next?
It does make it harder to predict what comes next. I think there's interesting conversations around, you know, because we haven't seen food riots in the UK recently, does that mean we'll never see them? Is it less likely that there will be a food riot? We have seen other sorts of riots in the UK, riots around racial discrimination or things of those sorts. So the question is really, what would the trigger point be for a food-related riot in the UK? We haven't seen it yet. A lot of the factors that we've seen in other countries, insecurity around food, long-term insecurity around food, are present in the UK. And in countries that are very close, like France or Spain, we have seen certainly large-scale food protests for a variety of different reasons and a variety of different political factors that go into that. So while we say we haven't seen them in the UK, we've seen them in countries that are very similar. So it may just be a question of time.
On the show, I covered studies showing multiple crop failures in key breadbaskets are possible as climate destabilization continues. Could crop failures in faraway places lead to food riots where you live? And I wonder what the delay time might be.
It certainly could. We've also looked at breadbasket failures in certain geographies, and especially where they're major contributors to global food prices. So, you know, extreme weather in the US could take out the international wheat market. And certainly in the past, where around 2007, prior to the Arab Spring and the food riots that we saw across North Africa, there was a huge increase in international food prices. So more than trebling of wheat prices, rice prices, and soybean and corn, maize. So that kind of increase, the trebling of international food prices of the raw ingredients, I don't translate into trebling of bread prices, but where you're directly exposed to that international price, so in certain developing countries, but your expectation of availability and access to food dramatically drops, and so you're much quicker to go out and protest. For somewhere like the UK, where there is a delay in the system through the prices because you don't see a trebling in the price of a loaf of bread or fruit and vegetables because there's a lot of marketing costs and supply chain costs that are added onto it, which makes it more of the bulk of the price, the delay can be longer than if you're directly exposed. So it's, you know, but that international price, it depends how quickly markets respond. And then what happens to the food on the international market? So far the UK has been able to buy it on international markets, but if there was a major bread basket failure and food prices went up by a factor of 3 or 5 again, and then if that meant the UK and other countries could outbid the UK on the international markets, then you'd expect to see some accessibility issues in the UK quite quickly, but it certainly wouldn't be within days. It would be within a season.
If you were tasked with writing a food security primer for the UK population at large, any ideas or tips for our listeners where you would start?
I think the most important thing really is that it is a system problem. So in terms of food security for the population at large, it's not really about going out and stockpiling and trying to protect our own. It's about talking to the community, talking to the people in authority, whether those are the local politicians within local councils, through to the national government, to say, you know, what are you doing about food security? Can you tell me how you're thinking about how the UK would withstand these future shocks, which are expected, which are within the system, and being open to change. One of the easiest ways of changing pressure on the food system is changing diet. Eating less meat takes some pressure out of the food system. But we need to see this more system change happening before we really expect individuals to be able to save the system by themselves.
From the Global Sustainability Institute at Cambridge, we've been speaking with Director Alan Jones. He led the paper Scoping Potential Routes to UK Civil Unrest via the Food System, Results of a Structured Expert Elicitation. Find links and more discussion in my show blog at ecoshock.org, published Wednesdays, and that's Thursday in Europe. I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Do you feel nervous about the food supply in coming years as the climate goes extreme? Here is a new wrinkle. The weak link in the global food chain that stretches to your door may be human. Agricultural workers face deadly levels of heat and humidity right when they need to plant or harvest crops that feed billions of people. To find the risks in a warming world, a Columbia University undergraduate student teamed up with scientists at the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory. They just published the paper, Increased Extreme Humid Heat Hazard Faced by Agricultural Workers. We reached the lead author, Connor Dunn-Diaz. Connor, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much, Alec. It's a pleasure to be here.
Most of our listeners buy their food at a grocery store. Why should we worry about conditions for agricultural workers as climate change ramps up?
Well, especially nowadays, the global food system is very connected. We have globalized logistics systems that are transporting food from thousands and thousands of miles away. So when we think about a warming world, we have to think about all of these different links in the supply chain and how are the distribution of food, and especially the impact of heat on the laborers, the crop workers who are harvesting this food, is impacting each one of those links in the supply chain.
And the key concept for our survival in extreme heat is the wet bulb temperature. It's not easy to grasp. How would you explain it?
Yeah, so wet bulb temperature is, at least here in the United States, akin to what we often see as the heat index. They're not exactly a one-to-one relationship, but what the heat index tries to capture is the combined effect of the what we call the dry bulb temperature, just the air temperature that you would feel outside, and the impact from humidity in the air. So we can think of wet bulb like the heat index, or the, you'd often hear it called, the real feel temperature outside, as trying to capture the combined effect of air temperature and humidity. If you're outside and it's a particularly muggy day, you're going to feel as if the temperature outside is much hotter than maybe just your dry bulb thermometer hanging outside the window might tell you.
And when it comes to heat and humidity, at what point does discomfort turn to possibly fatal danger?
So the threshold we used in our study was 27 degrees centigrade wet bulb. So this is roughly the boundary that the National Weather Service in the United States has identified as the boundary for danger to human health. Beyond this, when we reach 35 degrees centigrade wet bulb temperature, this has been identified in previous work as the theoretical lethal limit of wet bulb temperature.
I interviewed Dr. Daniel J. Vasilio. He's a postdoctoral scientist at Penn State, and his tests on actual humans, he used students, showed that people became uncomfortable and ranging towards sick at a much lower temperature. So I'm glad that you chose the 27-degree wet bulb temperature instead of 35.
Yeah, that's right. There's actually been a few papers that have come out in the past year that have tried to revise the differences between these thresholds in terms of discomfort, danger, and specific impacts to human health. We feel pretty comfortable that our 27 degrees is an appropriate threshold for the work we did here. But of course, there are so many different factors to take into account when we think about all the different activities that people might be doing outside, how acclimated they are to their specific climate, that these thresholds might be more variable than we think for different populations.
Well, most weather watchers are looking for absolute high temperatures, the dry bulb temperature. But as you cited in your report, a 2020 study led by Pinya Wang found extreme high wet bulb temperature is more sensitive to the changing climate than extreme high dry bulb temperature. Hot and humid events are intensified by global warming more than those hot, dry days. Are we looking at the wrong risks?
Yeah, that's right. I think that, you know, shifting our focus toward a measure like wet bulb or heat index puts us in the right direction to better capture the impacts of climate change on the human body here. Like you said, just dry bulb temperature doesn't really capture all of the variability that might really be impacting humans the most.
So how did you work out the risks for agricultural workers as climate change gets worse?
So the premise of our study was to combine three different sources of information. So we have our climate information, and for us, that was the daily maximum wet bulb temperature. So we have our climate information. Then we try and combine this with agricultural information. Because we're looking at the impact of agricultural workers specifically, we wanted to nail down what parts of the year these workers are most likely to be planting or harvesting in the field. So we took crop planting and harvest season dates from the global crop calendar data set, and we tried to line this up with our climate information and our threshold for danger to human health. We looked all around the globe, and we simply asked, if we are in a planting or harvest season for a specific crop, we looked at 12 in this study, if the workers are present in the field, are they exposed to a daily maximum wet bulb temperature greater than this threshold?
And so what crops are most affected when field conditions go beyond human tolerance?
So after looking at our data, what we found was that rice, maize, sorghum, and soybeans were the most impacted crops across the globe, which is notable because rice and maize specifically are two massively cultivated staple crops across the world.
Well, I'll note for our American listeners that maize is basically the same thing as corn, so that's what we're talking about there. Some places will be too hot to work during the day as long as 3 months of the year, you've found. Where are those first intolerable hotspots?
Yeah, so some of the most impacted regions in the world that we found for rice and maize, but also for many of the other crops in our study, are in Southeast Asia, the Philippines, Vietnam, parts of China. We also found potentially intolerable conditions in equatorial South America. Coastal Mexico is another region near Baja California that pops up. The Gulf of Guinea in Western Africa also is particularly exposed as well.
So I guess you didn't count places like Dubai or places on the Gulf because they are desert areas anyway. You were looking at big crop growing areas.
That's right. So ultimately, we were restricted in our analysis based on where we have data, where we have all of the data that we need for the analysis. So not only did we have to know that crops were harvested in a specific region, we had to have a fine enough resolution data on the planting and harvest dates for those crops. So those aren't completely available from these agricultural data sets, which, as we note in our paper, is a huge area for improvement. The more data that we can collect on agriculture and agricultural workers, where they're harvesting, what times of day they're harvesting, how many laborers are in the field, this is really important data that we're going to need in the future to be able to better pin down where these hazards are across the world. But places like Dubai do see extreme wet bulb temperatures coming off of the coast there. So while the hazard is there, data and large agricultural data in those countries might just not be available.
So have the amount of days too extreme for outdoor farm work increased since 1979? And is that speeding up as our emissions mount?
Yeah, so across our study period here, it was notable that in the past 20 years specifically, we saw most of the increase in these potential hazardous days to agricultural workers. Not only was the increase apparently nonlinear in these last 20 years, the impact from El Nino events was much larger, especially since the 1997-1998 El Nino events.
That's a little worrying because an El Nino heating just began around September of this year, 2023, and other studies found the worst of El Nino comes in the second or even third year, not right away. Do you expect extra heat stress for agricultural workers coming up in 2024 or 25?
Based on our analysis, I would. The 2016 El Nino was the largest spike in potential hazards to agricultural workers that we found. That was a very big El Nino event. And so I think it's reasonable to assume that we could see another spike like that for our next large El Nino event.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. Ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio Ecoshock. I'm Alex. Our guest is American researcher Connor Dunn-Diaz. We're talking about heat and humidity going beyond human tolerance and impacts on the global food chain. Connor, surely humans will find answers. They can work at night or retreat to cooling huts periodically. Maybe robots can do the harvesting. Given the scale of what you found, do you really think there are ways to adapt and keep the big global food chain going?
Yes, I do. I do. I think that one of the benefits of our study here is that it provides critical information to policymakers, to people in the agricultural industry, to begin to start thinking about how we can change our agricultural practices to best protect the workers, which really are the backbone of our global food system. Now, previous work has shown that our adaptability, different measures in keeping farm workers cool and healthy during the day might become less effective under these warming scenarios. But personally, I think if we take this information that we have at hand here, we can begin to think through ways of adapting our food system to, again, protect our agricultural workers who are holding up our global food system.
So should governments set and enforce outdoor worker safety limits? And is that practical when millions of people must plant and harvest or starve?
Yes, I think so. I think we have an opportunity here to start implementing some of these limits from the perspective of being able to keep our workers in the field during these critical seasons. I noticed a couple years ago during the Pacific Northwest heat wave, I remember hearing a report about strawberry harvesters harvesting overnight during those really, really brutal, brutally hot weeks there. You know, that might seem like an extreme to us now, harvesting throughout the night, but if we begin to establish limits and regulations around when people can be doing work outside, we can keep our agricultural system going.
And studies show that hospital visits go up during these hot, humid heat waves, and even chronic kidney disease in Central America has been attributed to this. So there are real-world consequences for those workers.
That's right. I think we're at a point here where we're beginning to get a critical mass of information linking these brutally hot heat waves to real impacts, not just agricultural workers. All sorts of outdoor workers, construction workers, are also found in the literature around the impacts of heat hazards. These really do have real impacts on people. The kidney disease research that you mentioned was particularly startling to me in that that seems some of the best evidence we have at the moment that is linking our warming climate to very granular person-to-person impacts.
And the study also highlights climate injustice. The people living in the regions shown in the maps in your paper, hardest hit by the heat and humidity, they're among the poorest. They hardly contributed to climate change, but they suffer most. Your thoughts?
We've cited some of the sociological research that has pointed out that, yes, agricultural workers are often some of the most vulnerable populations across the world. And I think it's really important to keep this in mind when we think about, you know, the next time you go to the grocery store, the next time you sit down to have a meal, you know, there are at-risk populations across the world that are working very hard in hazardous conditions here to make that happen. Moving forward, we really need to keep front and center the human dimension of our food system here in light of the fact that these laborers are so at risk across the world.
Do you think that if these crops fail because people just can't get out there to harvest them or to plant them, that that might stir up more immigration in safer countries to live in?
It seems plausible. I mean, I can't really, you know, that's not really my area of expertise. But I think what you're hitting on here is a great point to make, and it's the fact that we're looking at compound events here. You know, we often think about impacts to the crops themselves under extreme weather events, and now our study is looking at impacts to the human dimension of the agricultural system. There are follow-on impacts as well. Now, you know, what those may be in terms of immigration and different regional impacts to society, I don't know, but it's important to keep in mind that there are interlinking impacts that happen to society because of these climate extremes.
Well, although we don't really know it, in the developed world, about 27% of all workers in the world are agricultural workers. So this is really a key safety point that we need to know and something that we can do to protect people. We have been speaking with Connor Dunn-Diaz. Look for his new open access paper, Increased Extreme Humid Heat Hazard Faced by Agricultural Workers. I will put links to follow up in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Connor, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Alex. It was a great time being on.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Modern life reaches the fatal limits of the planet. Dr. Vanessa Andreotti is lead author of the book Hospicing Modernity. In this radio selection, Vanessa talks about the book and the University of British Columbia report, Moving with Storms.
Starting with a land acknowledgement, I would like to just affirm my responsibility as a settler, as a racialized settler in this place, to support Indigenous peoples to have their lands and lives restored. So I was asked today to talk a little bit about a book that I wrote called Hospicing Modernity and what is relevant of this book. So the book is called Hospicing Modernity, Facing Humanity's Wrongs and the Implications for Social Activism. And the word modernity there, that's the first chapter, is who the heck is modernity? And modernity is a single story, it's presented in the book as a single story of progress, development, and civilization that is expiring. And therefore, hospicing is about giving palliative care to a dying modernity while offering prenatal care to systems that could be in gestation, but that we don't yet know what they look like, and that they could be wiser, but not necessarily. It depends on how we are going to hospice the old in order to be able to welcome the new. So the wisdom of the new system depends on our ability to be taught by the mistakes of the old. Modernity is expiring because its promises of growth and prosperity have encountered the limits of the planet. And the book looks at the impact of modernity on our thinking, the ways we feel and process our feelings, our scope of relationships and relationality, and even our neurobiology. So it talks about how modernity both has given us specific gifts, but it also limits our existence in the planet. And it looks also at how education has contributed to these limitations and how education can actually support us in overcoming these limitations and bringing ourselves together to show up differently to each other and to the planet. In the book, modernity is sustained, the explanation is that modernity is sustained through four denials. So the first is the denial, and these denials are socially sanctioned. The first is the denial of systemic violence and complicity in harm, the fact that our comforts, securities, and enjoyments are subsidized by expropriation and exploitation somewhere else. They happen at the expense of other people, other species, and the land. The second is the denial of the limits of the planet, the fact that the planet cannot sustain exponential growth and consumption indefinitely. The third is the denial of entanglement, our insistence in seeing ourselves as separate from each other and from the land rather than entangled within a living wider metabolism that is biointelligent, that is the planet. And the fourth is the denial of the magnitude and complexity of the challenges we'll need to face together, the tendency to look for simplistic solutions that make us feel and look good and that may address symptoms but not the root causes of our collective hyper-complex predicament. So in the book, which is actually the result of the work of a collective called Gesturing Towards the Colonial Futures, we use lots of stories and metaphors to be able to engage people. We're using different parts of the brain with a different neurochemistry of learning. So one of the stories we tell is the story that modernity, of the house that modernity built. And in this story, we ask people to observe the different parts of themselves that relate to the story differently so that we can layer ourselves and understand our own complexity in engaging with stories. So this story comes both from the literature, critical literature, but also from the lived experiences of communities where the story was built and workshopped. So I will tell you the story, and I will invite you to think about and to observe the parts of yourself that relate differently to the story that I'm going to tell. So the story of the House of Modernity has four different parts. In the first part, we talk about the existence of a house on a planet, and the house is exceeding the limits of the planet. So this house is built on a foundation of separability, the separation between humans and nature. And it's an imposed sense of separation because we're actually not really separated. We're part of everything. But this sense of separation creates several implications for our existence, including the idea that in terms of our life, we need to produce value within the economies of the house to be deserving of being alive. And then other species are also, the value of other species are also measured according to the value they can produce in certain economies within the house. So the intrinsic value of life is one of the things that the separability, the separation between humans and nature, it's one of the things that it erodes. The separability also creates hierarchies between, not only between species, but also between cultures and between individuals. So the worth of individuals is always measured within the house according to how they produce and contribute to the economies within the house. This house has also two different carrying walls. The first carrying wall is the carrying wall of the nation state. And we tend to think about the nation state as being created to protect people. But the history of the nation state is actually a history of protecting property and property owners, and the protection of people through the dispensation of rights like human rights, civil rights or indigenous rights only happens when there's interest convergence between the interests of protecting people and the interests of capital and protecting property. Now, the other carrying wall is the carrying wall of universal reason. And this is the single story that I talked about before, the single story of progress, development, and civilization that creates epistemicides. It kills the possibility of aliveness for other stories, of other understandings of progress, other understandings of success, other understandings of development. And then we have the roof of global capital. It can take different shapes, but the current roof that we have is about speculative, shareholder, algorithmic capitalism. This roof in this story is structurally damaged for different reasons. I'm not going to go into them. In the book, we explain it a little bit more, but this structural damage is related to the irresponsible pursuit of profit for profit's sake. That's the first part of the story. The second part is about the hidden costs of the house. So you have the house, we have unsustainable growth within the house and overconsumption, and two arrows, one extracting and expropriating things from the planet, the other one dumping the waste on the planet. And in the planet, we see destitution, dispossession, genocides, and also ecocide. So this second part of the story about the hidden costs of the house show that the house has been created, it's subsidized, and is maintained by social and ecological violence. Then we have the third part of the story, which is about the floors of the house. And here we played a little bit with the idea of global north and south. But at the north of the north in the house, we have the penthouse where there is discretionary wealth, basically. And historically and systemically, this wealth is created in the construction of the house. And then we have in the middle the stairs of social mobility of the north of the south. Then we have the south of the north in the basement of the house, people who do not have access to social mobility, who may not want access to social mobility, may want to build different communities, but still within the protection of the house. And in the planet, we have the south of the south, those who are fighting for a different kind of existence and who are receiving the sewage of the house in their territory. So here I would put, for example, the struggle of the Hunikui people in the Amazon who are fighting against carbon trading or the financialization of nature, who are insisting that they are part of the forest, that they are the forest, and they do not want to live in a house. They want to continue to live in the forest, not because they are forced to, but that because that is a healthier form of existence. In relationship to this third part of the story, we have the questioning and challenging of the idea of the promise of social mobility, universal middle class for all, that reminds us that if we had the same standards of living of the working class, even of the global north, we would need many more planets. The estimate is 6 planets to live, because the levels of consumption and production that are necessary for this consumption are unsustainable. And there's already an offshoot of the limits of the planet in terms of consuming more than our fair share. Then we have the last frame of the house, talking about the structural damage of the roof and the weight of climate destabilization, biodiversity loss, economic instability, the cancellation of rights that we see in many countries, populism, populist governments being elected because people want to protect their interests within the house, and a lot of precarity. So we have social, economic, political, mental health, and ecological crisis within the house. And then we see more violent conflict and mass and forced migration also in the planet. So the question here then, do we fix the house? Do we expand the house? Do we deal with another house? Do we live without a house? Or do we find another planet? And as we engage with these questions, we have also mapped 3 different streams of perspective. So some people will advocate for soft reform of the house with more modernity as the answer to the problems of modernity, the same idea of forward, same kind of leadership, just small changes. So same usual questions, same answers. Then there's radical reform, more modernity, but different leadership and larger changes. Same questions, different answers. But then there's beyond reform, where it's acknowledged that more modernity is not an option, given the violence required to keep modernity in place in the limits of the planet. So here there are different questions and different answers. We have a report called Moving with Storms that talks about the lessons learned in this material, like concrete experiment. And one of the things that we learned is that inviting people into the process of hospicing is hard. There's more and more people interested right now. And it comes with a lot of anxiety and a lot of grief also for the planet and for everything that's happening. So one of the things that we needed to do as part of the educational inquiry was expand people's capacity to sit with difficult and painful things without relationships falling apart, without people feeling overwhelmed and immobilized, and without people demanding a rescue from the discomfort of this experience. And we developed a set of invitations that really helped people to come to the space and to show up in a different way. And this is what I'm going to conclude my presentation with by sharing those with you. It's an invitation for 7 steps back and 7 steps forward or aside. And here are the invitation for the 7 steps forward or aside. The first is the invitation to step forward or aside with honesty and courage, to see what you don't want to see. The second is the invitation to step forward or aside with humility, to find strength in openness and vulnerability. Number 3 is about stepping forward or aside with self-reflexivity, so that you can read how you're being read and learn to read the room. Number 4 is stepping forward or aside with self-discipline, to do the work on yourself so that you don't become work for other people. 5 is stepping forward or aside with maturity, to do what is needed rather than only what you want to do. Number 6 is stepping forward or aside with extending discernment and attention, increasing care in proportion to risk. And number 7 is stepping forward or aside with adaptability, flexibility, stamina, and resilience for the long haul, to be prepared to fall, to fail, to have our plan shattered, to be stretched, to change course, and to find joy in the struggle itself rather than in the imagined prize, promised outcome at the end.
Vanessa Andreotti is currently Dean of the Faculty of Education at the University of Victoria. Her book is Hospicing Modernity, Facing Humanity's Wrongs and the Implications for Social Activism, published in 2021. The selection for radio comes from her presentation July 21st, 2023, posted by the Joseph Rowntree Foundation. You can find links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. We are out of time. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
Coming up in the second hour tomorrow, that's tomorrow, Thursday, on Law and Disorder, a fresh broadcast.
How do we stop ourselves sleepwalking into another Great Depression? It's breathtaking. You know, for folks that are listening to this, I don't know if they realise the extent of the tax injustice issue, that you've got these major corporations and rich people that go offshore with the money. People get away with it.
World leaders meet and they discuss the big issues, inequality, climate crisis, but the whole thing is a charade.
I think prison should be very real for accounting professionals who advise on aggressive tax avoidance schemes, without a doubt.
What we know about how the mainstream media reported on the financial crisis is that the deeper structural problems with the banking sector weren't really covered.
The majority of the public now understand that there is an emergency. People need to know that there's something that can be done.
There is a new dawn which is happening. The resistance is coming from the old guard.
This opens up a crucial debate about how humankind wants to develop over the course of the coming century.
Join me, Naomi Fowler, and John Christensen for the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. We talk about how we take back control from the super rich and powerful and make our economies work for all of us. You can find us on most podcast apps and your favourite radio station can broadcast us for free. Get more information on us on www.taxjustice.net/TaxCast. See you there.
That's right. It's a great show. It really is. It teaches you a lot about how billionaires hide their money, not just in how they hide their money, and where it goes, and how they do it all to avoid paying taxes for the betterment of the majority of us in the world. Well. Coming up now, and that's on Thursday in the second hour. Now we have Mariah Gilardin's TUC Radio. Thank you for listening.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. War and Peace, the Climate Toll. At the COP28 in Dubai, Facing Futures TV hosted a press conference on the impact of military operations on the climate. The speakers are concerned that at a time when humanity needs to focus on the restoration of land and water, wars around the planet are destroying cities, lives, and ecosystems. Peace is essential, they say, for keeping the climate system from catastrophic failure. Raya Salter and Carlos Garcia are co-hosts of this panel on the impact of war and peace on the climate, and they will in turn introduce the other speakers. Here first is Carlos Garcia, Vice President of Impact and Partnership for the ASTRA Project. The ASTRA Project also hosted the COP28 Methane Reduction Intensive. That took place on December 10, 2023. Carlos Garcia.
Good afternoon and welcome everyone to Facing Future TV and the Climate Toll of War and Peace as Climate Action Program live from COP28. This session takes a deep dive into the intricate relationship between conflict, peace, and the profound implications for climate action. Our esteemed panelists will explore the climate impacts of conflict and underscore the fundamental importance of peace as a catalyst for effective climate action. Join us as we delve into the intersection of climate and peace examining how climate action not only responds to, but also fosters peace, both in principle and in practical terms. The dialogue will span diverse topics ranging from the carbon footprint of military activities to resource exploitation during conflicts, and with a special emphasis on practices for regenerative agriculture and to contribute to the creation of sustainable peace. Together, we will unravel the broader implications of the global environmental and climate goals, forging a path forward of harmonious coexistence of climate action and lasting peace. My name is Carlos Garcia. I'm the Vice President of Impact and Partnership for the Astra Project. And my co-host, Raya Salter.
I'm Raya Salter. I'm host with Facing Future TV and the founder and executive director of the Energy Justice Law and Policy Center based in New York.
And now we will do an introduction of our esteemed panelists.
All right, so we are joined by three experts in this area. First, we'll hear from Tamara Lawrence. She is a PhD candidate in global governance from the Basile School for International Affairs. She also has an LLB, JD, and MBA specializing in environmental law and management. She's a member of the Canadian Pugwash Group, the Canadian Voice for Women for Peace, and the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. We will also hear today from Dr. Amara Enya. She is a strategist and public policy expert on city and state policy, as well as international affairs with expertise in Africa, Latin America, and Central Asia. She serves as the director of policy and research for the Movement for Black Lives, and is also the chairwoman of the International Working Group for the United Nations Permanent Forum on People of African Descent, and chairwoman of the Working Group on Global Economic Systems, Institutions, and Policy. And last but not least, we will hear from Mr. John Liu, a filmmaker and ecologist, as well as an ecosystem ambassador for the Common Land Foundation. As a journalist, ecological researcher, and ecosystem ambassador, he has traveled extensively throughout the world and is sort of known as the Indiana Jones of ecosystem restoration. So first, please, will you go ahead and share with us tomorrow?
Good afternoon, everyone. It's really nice to be with you, and I'm glad that we're having this conversation on climate change, conflict, and peace. I would like to talk quickly about three points. The first is the emissions from war and militarism are overlooked at this conference of the parties, and it has been for many years, and that's because in 1997, at the Kyoto Protocol negotiations, the United States ensured that military emissions were not part of the Kyoto Protocol, that they would be exempted. And so this problem of emissions from war and militarism have been really ignored for the past 25 years. But we know that for all countries, the largest public institutional consumer of fossil fuels is the military. So the fact that this continues to be ignored is a huge problem, particularly for adaptation. And if we think right now about the wars in Gaza, in Ukraine, in Somalia, in Congo, in Sudan, and think about the emissions from these wars, the use of tanks, of fighter jets, of warships, you know, how they are exacerbating the climate crisis. Two British NGOs have estimated that global military emissions account for about 5%. This is an underestimate, but this is a huge part of the problem. The other point that I want to make is that one of the key priorities at this conference is the issue of climate finance, but an area of public funding that is being ignored in the conversation is military spending. According to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute last year, global military spending reached its highest level ever of $2.2 trillion. But it's the 31 countries of NATO, led by the United States, that accounts for 60% of global military spending. But this is exactly the amount of money that we need for the just transition, for renewables, to get off fossil fuels. And then finally, I want to say quickly that we know that one of the most important climate solutions is peace for cooperation. If you read the Sixth Assessment Report that came out in March, you will see that one of the things that they highlight is that international cooperation is the crucial enabler for ambitious climate adaptation, mitigation, and resilience. In order for us to have that international cooperation, we need peace. We need to end the wars, and we need to cooperate on tackling our greatest human security challenge, and that is climate change. Thanks.
Thank you so much for reminding us. the massive amount of energy consumption, right, within the war industrial complex. As you mentioned, from the fuel usage to the war fleets, I think something overlooked as well is energy consumption, right? When military bases go into these war-trodden countries, the demand that it puts on an already weakened grid, and in some cases grids that are being attacked, right? It's an idea and a topic that not many people want to think about, but that you very much so pointed out that we should, right? So, Dr. Mara, help us understand these issues from a transnational security and sustainability aspect. That's your expertise, the policy, the international affairs. Help us understand, put this in context for us.
Thank you. Thank you so much, and thank you both for hosting and for these initial comments, which I think are the perfect opener for this panel discussion and talking about militarism and the toll of militarism on the loss of life, but also the extraordinary amounts of spending that are going toward expanding military bases, that are going to wars, while we see at the national level in many countries basic needs not being met. And I think it's important to highlight the discrepancy between what is spent on war, which is actually fueling the climate crisis, versus what is actually spent on ensuring that people within their countries have their basic needs met, what they need to survive, whether it be housing, access to jobs, access to health care. And this is something that is causing increasing unrest at the grassroots level. Anyone who is aware is hearing the resistance and the pushback against how much is being requested for war, even as we are facing challenges domestically. The second point that I think it's important to bring up is that we cannot have the kind of peace that we talk about with the existing economic discrepancies around the world. And so issues of monetary sovereignty, of economic sovereignty, particularly when we look at the challenges that so many countries have faced under the existing global order, where they are stressed by debt that they can never hope to repay. This has been a challenge in many African countries, where the money that should be going toward ensuring a high-quality life is actually going to pay down debt, where when we experience shocks, for example, in the United States, inflation, it hits other countries whose economies are tied to the dollar in extraordinary ways. And so when we talk about peace, it's not just in the context of an ending war, but it is in the context of what does a high quality of life mean, and how do we change the systems and structures, specifically the global financial architecture that has actually exacerbated conflict and has created untenable circumstances, particularly in the global south. So that economic component is extraordinarily important. And third, this notion of conflict and obscuring the true causes of conflict. When we look at the climate crisis, for example, in Africa and the Sahel region and the expanding Sahara, what we're seeing is that in many instances where actually climate issues are being characterized as ethnic issues or religious issues, or what are actually climate issues are exacerbating what may be ethnic tensions or religious tensions. And we've seen this a lot. So with the Sahel, with the Sahara expanding south, we're seeing some of the nomadic groups that live in the region having to come further and further south into other regions for their livelihood. And what's happening from there is that we're seeing some clashes and conflicts in those areas, but it's not being characterized as a climate issue, that climate issues are actually security issues or can easily become security issues. Instead, we fall into the usual tropes of these are just, ethnic conflicts or religious conflicts. And that's quite dangerous because it means that they are ignoring the root cause of many of these issues. And so the interventions will not be appropriate. The interventions will not be fit for purpose. And so when it comes to this issue of peace and conflict, we have to pay attention to the ways in which climate issues are actually obscuring to where climate issues are being overlooked, and so the problems are not being correctly identified, and it's exacerbating conflicts in many regions, particularly where we're seeing the results of the climate crisis, whether in the Sahel region or even if you go to other regions where drought is causing conflict, where people who are more nomadic are having to travel farther and farther out for resources. We're seeing in the Delta region, for example, in Nigeria, where the lands are being destroyed by oil companies. People whose livelihoods are based on the water are finding it harder and harder to survive. And so it has a compounding effect that can actually lead to additional conflicts and crises. So those are the three biggest points when it comes to looking at the national level, but also looking at transnationally, what are some of these impacts?
Thank you for bringing to our attention how we need to look at the root causes. Thank you so much for that. Next, John Liu, if you could please share sort of how eco-restoration is an actual act of peace.
In China, we say it's not a good thing if we're living in interesting times. We're living in interesting times. And so this means that we're required to face what's going on. And we have multiple issues. These issues are directly seen in the wars, but we have climate change, we have biodiversity loss, we have extreme and erratic weather events, hydrological disruptions, we're facing flooding, drought, wildfires, food insecurity, financial collapse, and all of our problems are interrelated. They're all pretty much the same. And the answer to them, while the problems are complicated, the solutions are not really complex. We need to restore all degraded lands on the earth, and it's possible to do this. We know how to restore degraded landscapes. I hope you'll all watch Hope in a Changing Climate, or Regreening the Desert, or Kiss the Ground, or The Age of Nature. And there'll be a new film coming out about the rehabilitation of the Luz Plateau in the upper and middle reaches of the Yellow River next year. There, a desertified area of enormous scale that was desertified over thousands of years was restored. And we can see that it's possible to bring back hydrological function, to bring back food security, to bring back full employment. You can restore desertified landscapes. And it's not theoretical. It's not a policy issue. It's not simply about money. You need money. You need a policy that's enabling. But the real need is understanding and people to do the physical work. So it means that everyone in the region is engaged in ecological restoration. And when they do this, it is more valuable than anything else you could possibly do. Ecological restoration, functional ecosystems, are more valuable than anything that human beings have ever made and everything that human beings will ever make. Because everything that humans create will eventually collapse. And the functional ecosystems are self-replicating. So they continuously renew. They create, constantly filter, and continuously renew the oxygenated atmosphere, the fresh water system, the fertile soils, and the biodiversity. And when everyone on the planet understands that, and we value it, we can have a shared understanding and a shared intention. And this is the way to make peace. This is the way to have everyone be in fully engaged, not employed, not having a few billionaires and billions of serfs working under them, but everyone on earth being free and autonomous and sovereign, and having lands that don't belong to anyone because we're going to die. We're walking on the bones of all the life that has ever lived on the planet. So we can't own the earth owns us. And this is what we need to understand, and we need to ensure that future generations of life have fully functional ecosystems. And the way to do that is to restore all degraded lands on the planet. So watch those films. Contact me if you want to. And happy to work with everyone who's in this. We're building ecosystem restoration communities around the world. It's growing really fast, and lots of people are working in them.
John, thank you so much. And I think, yeah, please. One of the things that I think we're constantly reminding how interconnected everything is, right? How a little beetle and the ecosystem of its survival is so vital to everything else, to birds and then to frogs and then to amphibians, and how that connects to wildlife and ecosystems. And so, Dr. Meyer, one of the things that I always talk about is, you know, we have this thing called climate change, right? Think of it like a man with the scissors running around, or a knife running around, cutting everybody. And people want to put a Band-Aid instead of stopping the man with the scissors, right? That's the way I kind of look at these things. And so you talked a little bit about the negative feedback loops that we have, right, with war. Can you put that a little bit in the context of what that looks like gender-specific-wise? What is it like for men versus women versus children? How are these things kind of all interconnected? Doctor, please.
Yeah, so that's a really good question. I appreciate that question. I think if we look at the cultural norms and ways of being and existing of Africans, and indigenous people, that notion of interconnectedness is a worldview. It's an understanding that informs how you build your society, how you build your systems, and how you build your structures. And so the attempt to put a Band-Aid on the climate crisis treats the climate crisis as though it is a discrete thing, separate and apart from the way that human beings have come to live now. Mm-hmm. And I would say decided, but it hasn't been decided by the masses. It was decided by those who had the power to enforce a particular worldview on everyone else. And so we happen to live within that system, within those systems. And so it's not the specific discrete intervention of, for example, carbon markets that's going to resolve the climate crisis. I would liken that to attempting to put the Band-Aid on the man with the knife, as you mm-hmm. described. It is a fundamental reexamination of how we live on this planet. And do we actually have a respect for human life, but also for plant life, for animal life, for all of the systems and structures that govern our existence? We cannot address the climate crisis without that. And what I've seen in so many conferences and gatherings is these attempts to sort of extract, I guess, no pun intended, extract specific aspects of a crisis and try to address that, but we leave the really big picture largely unaddressed, or the purview of, you know, people on the fringes. These systems are all interconnected, right? So anyone, perhaps if you have a science background, you know how systems intersect. They are not separate and apart. The only way to address a climate crisis is to address it as a whole, understanding that all of these systems are connected to one another. It's why I lift up economic systems, because so often we separate that as the purview of economists who largely have contributed to some of the thinking that has created the climate crisis, right? So we have to have a holistic view. Anyone who is working to address the climate crisis has to have a holistic view, even if your intervention is in a specific lane. As it relates to the gender component, again, how we have decided that we are going to live on this planet. If we have systems that tend to marginalize particular groups, whether it's based upon gender or race or socioeconomic status, it means that we are accepting that they are relegated to a lower quality of life than everyone else, and that has often been the case for women. We just listened to a panel of African women talking about the interventions that they've done in their towns and villages around agroecology, seed sovereignty, food sovereignty. Why is that important? Because they are holding that work for their communities. They are holding the bulk of that work for their communities. So if we marginalize their voices, then what the woman was just explaining about how they are saving their seeds, reusing their seeds, that knowledge is lost. And so it just speaks to the importance of having an inclusive vision, that our systems change has to be inclusive, that it has to include gender, it has to include race, it has to include socioeconomic background. We cannot start to parse out who gets access to climate solutions or whose voices or whose thinking is prioritized in climate solutions and those who aren't. And I would end to say that it's precisely because we've had this exclusionary vision of who gets to build these existing systems that we're in this climate crisis. Because, see, if we had actually valued the voices of our indigenous people, the voices of those who believe in Ubuntu, the voices of those who actually see the connectedness of our systems and honor life in general, perhaps we wouldn't be here. So it's all the more important that we start to look to particularly those folks and those voices who have been marginalized to help us find the way out of the crisis.
Doctor, I think, you know, the one thing that has been made clear to me, I think, since college, statistically, when women succeed, we all succeed. When women get educated in a country, the country does better writ large. And war and climate change has a negative impact more so than anyone else on women and children. And so we have to look at this also from the lens of gender equality, right? How do we fix this? What are the levers? What are the friction points? And how do we make things go smoother, more efficiently? So, as always, agree with you. New climate initiative from COP. So tell us about how that's going to break this negative loop and negative externality cycle.
Yeah, so I'd like to bring to your attention initiatives that have taken place coming from the top and then also coming from the grassroots, trying to bring peace into the COP space and into these climate conversations. So last year at COP27 in Sharm el-Sheikh, the Egyptian presidency announced a new initiative called Climate Responsiveness for Sustainable Peace. And then that paved the way for the UAE presidency over this past year to try to do more work on bringing peace into COP. So this year, for the very first time, we had peace on the thematic program, and that was yesterday alongside health, relief, and recovery. Peace was on the agenda. And in a high-level event, the UAE presidency announced a new declaration for relief, recovery, and peace, and a package of voluntary solutions. Now, this is something that's outside of the formal negotiations. It's voluntary, and it is targeted to conflict-affected communities and countries that are even more adversely impacted by the climate crisis because of the state of conflict that they're in, and so trying to direct resources and programs to them. 90 countries signed on to this declaration, and about 40 NGOs, including UN organizations, have signed on to this declaration. So that's something that's encouraging, that's coming from the top level. And at the grassroots level, last year, under the Women, Gender constituency, which is one of the constituencies under the UNFCCC, established a demilitarization and peace working group. And so over this past year, again, women have been working together to try to bring peace, disarmament, demilitarization into the climate space, you know, saying that we need to demilitarize, to decarbonize. And I want to just end with something that the foreign minister from Colombia said at the high-level panel yesterday, and that is he emphasized that we need global peace for us to work collaboratively on dealing with the climate crisis. So let's heed his words. Let's heed the work of the women and the indigenous people who are trying to get peace on the agenda, disarmament and demilitarization. That's the work ahead for us. Thanks.
Thank you so much for that. Thank you to our panelists. Thank you, Carlos. And we also want to give thanks to the International Society for Ecological Economics. Thank you so much for coming to this program, and we'll see you next time on Facing Future TV.
That was Raya Salter. Co-host was Carlos Garcia. For the Facing Futures TV panel on War and Peace, the Climate Toll. This press conference was held at the COP28 in Dubai on December 4, 2023. Raya Salter is an energy justice movement attorney, activist, author, and the founder and executive director of the Energy Justice Law and Policy Center. She's a member of the New York State Climate Action Council. The speaker before her was Tamara Lawrence. She's a longtime environmentalist, feminist, peace activist, and PhD candidate at Wilfrid Laurier University. She's also on the advisory committee of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space and the No Tornado Network. And she's been a guest on TUC Radio before. The other two panelists were John Liu, a journalist, filmmaker, and ecologist. His work documents that it is possible to restore natural ecological systems rather than simply accepting their loss. John Liu has produced and directed dozens of films on environment and ecology. They have aired on the BBC, National Geographic, Discovery, PBS, and other networks. And Dr. Amara Enya is a strategist and public policy expert on city and state policy, as well as international affairs, with expertise in Africa, Latin America, and Central Asia. Find the full recording of this press conference, held on December 4, 2023, at the COP28 in Dubai, on the YouTube channel of Facing Futures TV. Look for the title, War and Peace, The Climate Toll. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.